Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. Tonight, male airline stewards and their role in civil rights. My guest is the author of a fascinating new book, Plain Queer: Labor, Sexuality, and AIDS in the History of Male Flight Attendants. Is it true that most male flight attendants are gay? Was it ever true? How did they and their legal battles with the airline industry help advance not only gay rights, but workplace gender equity? How were they sometimes embraced and sometimes shunned by other interests in labor and civil rights? And how much of the tale of Patient Zero, a male flight attendant reputed as being the initial transcontinental spreader of HIV, is true? Well, put your tray tables away and your seats in their fully upright and locked positions for a hop, skip, and a puddle jump through the fascinating history of male flight attendants and their impact on the labor movement and civil rights. Our tour guide is Phil Teemeyer, assistant professor of history at Philadelphia University, who served a year as a Guggenheim Fellow at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., and has been an air travel buff since he was just a young boy. Professor Phil Teemeyer, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thanks, Eric. It's great to be here.
Well, since I asked at the beginning, are most male flight attendants today gay?
Today, it's become more and more mixed we don't have exact numbers, of course, but there's a strong and growing number of straight men who do this job, much more so than, say, in the 1970s, which was probably aviation's gayest years if you're looking at the flight attendant corps.
Okay. And so what percentage of flight attendants today are male, for that matter?
So the numbers have been pretty consistent since 1971 when all airlines were forced to hire men. And it's around 15%, give or take, at various airlines.
Okay. Yeah, I'm almost surprised. It almost seems like there's more than 15%. But so how far back in time does the male flight attendant and the gay steward go?
So this is what surprised me when I did the research, is to find out that actually the very first flight attendants were men as opposed to women. We sort of misremember the history as though it was always a profession where stewardesses were the ones doing this work. But actually, I kind of used the start date of when Pan American Airways, one of the great U.S. carriers, had their first flight attendant, which was in 1928. And it was actually a Cuban-American by the name of Amari Sanchez, who was the first flight attendant for Pan Am. And the first female then came along about 2 years later in 1930. And that's kind of the way that history usually starts in 1930.
So why is it that men were used primarily in the early days as flight attendants, as stewards?
So aviation, as you might guess, with its connections with the military world and engineering and technology industries, was considered a man's domain. It was honestly, it shouldn't surprise us the way it did surprise me when I realized this, that the first flight attendants, like the first pilots and engineers and so forth, were men. It was just an appropriate thing, or seemed so at the time. And of course, there were more accidents as well. It was considered a very dangerous realm to be up in the air. And the flight attendant, among his other duties in the early years, was to look after passengers in case of emergency landings and otherwise.
Mm-hmm. So I assume it sort of followed the model of shipping or the passenger ship industry and the whole almost sort of paramilitary might be too strong of a word, but sort of following a military model, right?
Right. It was very much a military model. And if you look at flight attendant uniforms, even today, some of the carriers still have stripes on their sleeves and have wings on their lapels. And this all comes from the Navy, which is what the kind of the inspiration for pilot uniforms and flight attendant uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Now, commercial aviation in the early years, we're looking at talking about the 1930s, basically was gay in a different sort of way than we use the word today. You had to be kind of rich to fly, right? And perhaps a little eccentric, or at least
definitely rich. And it certainly helped if you were eccentric. One thing that's really interesting to know about air travelers in the early 30s is that life insurance companies refuse to insure you and cover your death in case of air accident. So you did have to be very wealthy, but you also had to be a little bit eccentric, I guess you could say. And what this did is that it meant that the first air travelers were often city folks from places like New York, Chicago, San Francisco to some extent, who were part of a very upper crust society. And this was just kind of the end of the Prohibition years, when nightlife was very kind of out there in places like Harlem, and where sexual experimentation, including some experimentation with homosexuality, was more tolerated amongst this class of folks. And so I can't say
we'll have a gay old time. That's right, the kind of connotation
exactly.
That word had.
That's the word where the word gay came from, and was primarily used in the 1920s and 30s to kind of refer to having a great time, right? So I can't say for fact that there were gay flight attendants in the 30s. Most of them, almost everyone who flew at that time has passed away, unfortunately. But what we do know is that the airlines made a distinct attempt. Airlines like Pan Am and Eastern, some of the great U.S. carriers, made a distinct attempt to sort of market their flight attendants, their male flight attendants, as part of this upper crust society. So they dressed them sort of like what you would see from elevator attendants, bus boys, bellhops.
It's an ad mock-up of in your book that shows this male steward in a very slimming outfit, shall we say. Can you describe that?
Sure. When Eastern Airlines made the choice to hire only men in 1934, they introduced this very, what's called the streamlined look, and it matched the look of the airplane at the time that they were introducing the DC-3. The DC-3 is sort of the first airline with kind of integrated wings. So it's sleeker than the old kind of images of early planes that we might have in our heads. And so they wanted their flight attendants to be sleek as well. So these uniforms are kind of broad at the shoulders, and they kind of thin down at the waistline, and they proceed on a really thin line all the way down to the ankles. And so you can kind of imagine some folks making the connection that the steward is now kind of dressed like the airplane itself. And these colors of these uniforms were what really struck me. It's a white coat with dark pants, and then there's red piping on the coat, and a cute little bow tie that also has some red in it. So this was a really flashy, high-class kind of uniform, and also sexually appealing because it really did kind of cut these men's figures.
Accentuated the body line,
exactly.
Shall we say. And I guess they had to be slim was a requirement for the job in those
slim
days.
And small, honestly. Weight was at a premium in early aircraft, and so there were, I think, 5'6" might have been the max height that you could be as a flight attendant.
I'm perfect.
And we're talking about men who were about 120 pounds.
Okay, well, I'm not perfect there. Oh, well. So when were the men displaced by women primarily as flight attendants?
So we have to remember, because this was such a male-dominated sphere, that the first trailblazer were the first women who, and there's a woman named Ellen Church who approached the executives of what's now United Airlines, it used to be called Boeing Air, and she had this idea that women could do this job too. And the executives at first were really suspicious of this idea because of what they perceived the kind of the engineering illiteracy of women and maybe their lack of capacity to deal with emergencies or stressful situations. So Ellen had this idea. She said, all we'll do is we'll hire certified nurses at the beginning. And so every woman who was hired by any airline in the United States up until World War II was a certified nurse. Mm. Plus, was a young female, unmarried, etc. And this is kind of where what I would say the love affair between America and its stewardesses started, because what you see in the 30s is that newspaper articles start to get written. People like Ed Sullivan write into the New York Times and say, those stewardesses I had on my flight out to L.A. were just lovely women in all regards, you know. And then there was a stewardess movie that was made in 1938 with a famous actress, and I'm totally blanking on her name. But she definitely played up the attractiveness element of the women who were doing this job, and even let her kind of the newspaper interviewer in on a secret that every flight attendant, every female flight attendant who flew for the airlines was obliged to say yes if asked out on a date by a customer.
Really?
Right.
Okay, uh-huh.
So you've got...
Did they actually have to go, or they just had to say yes until the flight was over?
I think they at least had to go to a luncheon, right?
Okay.
Or who knows? Because most of the time we're dealing with passengers who were returned customers.
Uh-huh.
And so what we see already in the 30s, even though a good, say, 30% of flight attendants are still men in the 30s. Because of this love affair, if you will, with the stewardess, men are becoming increasingly considered by the common public as ill-suited for this job because it is this sex-oriented, appealing, physically alluring sort of position.
And then World War II came along.
And then World War II came along, which created a labor shortage for men in this country because men were being sent off to the military. And this is where even companies like Pan Am and Eastern that hired only men up until that time started to hire women as well.
Mm-hmm. And so during the war years, I mean, was the entire flight attendant corps female then?
There were still some stewards who were able to kind of justify their positions as equivalent to military service. And in fact, Pan Am, which had the most militarily speaking sensitive routes because they had routes down to the Panama Canal, for example, they kept exclusively men on the long haul flights from Miami down to the Canal Zone or further on to South America. Meanwhile, they would let women take the short routes over from Miami to the Bahamas or down to Cuba or wherever else.
Mm-hmm. So after World War II, when did men start coming back into the occupation and why? What opened the gates and saw men come to the profession, back to the profession in big numbers?
Sure. So right after World War II, you have sort of two different sort of opposing forces that are playing on the issue of hiring men for this job. On the one hand, U.S. society as a whole really wanted to reward men for their military service after the war. And so even airlines and even for this position of flight attendant gave priority to men returning from the war. And so you see an increase starting with 1946 all the way up through until the Korean War in 51 or so that airlines like Pan Am and Eastern go back to the habit of hiring primarily men. And even airlines like Delta and Braniff, who had never hired men before, started hiring men right after World War II as a form of almost affirmative action, if you will, mm-hmm. for the veterans, for the men who
returning veterans,
who served
right.
so valiantly. Right. Meanwhile, this is also becoming the most homophobic decade of U.S. society. The McCarthy years, the 50s, are well documented as one of the worst times for gay men. Right. And the more that men in this position, despite their military brass now, because so many of them were veterans, the more that they were occupying a female-oriented profession, a service profession in the 1950s, the more they stood out as suspicious, mm-hmm. that they weren't quite fully the type of men that America was valorizing at the time.
Right. You're hearing Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. My guest is Phil Teemeyer, assistant professor of history at Philadelphia University and author of Plain Queer, Labor, Sexuality, and AIDS and the History of Male Flight Attendants. From sex discrimination lawsuits to the myth of patient zero, Plain Queer offers a novel approach to understanding gay rights and the civil rights movement by tracing the role of men in commercial air travel from its early beginnings through modern times. Before I forget, how could folks find out about your book? Is there info?
Yeah, I think the easiest way is to kind of do a little Google search on plain queer. The press, University of California Press, has good information about it. It's up on Amazon.
By the way, plain queer, P-L-A-N-E, plain queer.
Right.
So when did the – you mentioned that there's some sexualization going on in the 30s when women had to agree to a date. And did it become more overtly sexualized in the 70s? I'm thinking of the coffee tea or me era, the air mattress. And as we were talking on the way here to the station, the Fly Me campaign.
Right.
That was the 1970s?
It was very early 70s. National Airlines out of Miami painted the names of stewardesses on their planes. They would call them Jenny, for example. And then in their commercials, a stewardess named Jenny would say, "Hi, I'm Jenny. Fly me to New York." And right. it was as crass and over the top in terms of its sexual objectification of stewardesses that the airline industry ever got. Now, this kind of comes out of that 1950s era, honestly. I mean, one thing we didn't get to mention is that by 1958, the degree of homophobia and the degree of this love affair with stewardesses in American society had crystallized to such a point that by 1958, even Eastern and Pan Am stop hiring men for this job. And so by the early 70s, by the late 60s at least, you only got a remnant of about 4% of the flight attendant corps who are men. And they were all hired before, say, 1955, 56.
Okay.
And that means that this gave the airlines even greater permission to sort of sexualize the stewardess corps. And so what you see from the 50s into the 60s is that skirt lines for flight attendant uniforms, stewardess uniforms, start going up above the knee.
I remember a phrase, reading a passage in the book last week that some women were complaining that they couldn't bend over without their underwear showing.
Right, right. It was that bad. You had things, the sleeves were heading up towards the shoulders, and the skirts were heading way up above towards the waistline. And it became really uncomfortable for a lot of these women, as you can imagine, to be put in a position where they were trying to do work, and yet even their employer was putting them in a position of sexual objectification.
Right, right.
And that's when, you know, the Fly Me campaign was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what women had to endure in this profession in the late 60s and early 70s was its most extreme, arguably.
So now then there was this case in the late 60s where Celio Diaz sued, was it Pan Am?
Pan Am, actually, yeah.
So tell us about that case and how pivotal it was in bringing. So this is what brought men, stewards, into like in flocking in large numbers, and at that time mostly gay, right?
Right. And so, again, the irony of timing is that as the airlines are kind of publicly producing their most kind of in-your-face, sexually objectifying images of stewardesses through their ad campaigns, a man in Miami named Celio Diaz, who's a straight guy, and he actually worked most of his life as a trucker, so he's pretty stereotypically straight. But he had this passion and this desire to go out and see the world, so he really wanted to be a flight attendant. His education level was good enough, high school level, and he knew that this was one of the few careers that could get him out of Miami and allow him to see the larger world. And so in 1967, he put an application in with Pan Am at their Miami office, and they promptly threw it in the trash and told him, "There's no way you're going to get this job because you're a man and we don't hire men." Diaz had heard of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and knew that one of the provisions of this act was to forbid workplace discrimination based on sex or gender, as we now call it, right? So in theory, no longer was it allowed that certain workplaces could be kept by employers as women only and certain workplaces as men only. So Diaz was one of many voices, most of them women, who challenged these hiring practices. And his case received particular scorn at the time in the late 60s because even the folks who were sympathetic to a law that protected women's access to work really probably hadn't imagined that a man would take this law and invoke sex discrimination as a basis to become a member of a heavily female career.
Right.
And so he's sort of the inspiration for the title of the book, The Plain Queer. He's also the inspiration for the cover image of the book, which...
Yeah, please tell us about that.
Yeah, so the cover image is actually from the Miami Herald in 1968, and it depicts a male model who is dressed in skirt and a pillbox hat and has a lovely purse in his hand.
A red blazer and the skirt is blue and he's got socks that come to just short of his knees.
So he's dressed
he's really
as a
only
dapper.
Exposing his knees. He's
right,
not
exactly.
That
it's not that sexual, but the fact that he's in women's clothing certainly kind of points out that
the handbag really does it. That puts it over the top, I think, even more than the skirt, in my opinion, but you know.
So clearly
otherwise it could be a kilt.
Right. The editorial staff of the Miami Herald thought that Diaz's court case was absurd. And so they ran this image of their male model in stewardess attire under the headline, "Is This Any Way to Ruin an Airline?"
Mm-hmm.
And it was accompanied, as you can guess, with scathing text about the absurdity of the civil rights law, especially the provision that granted equality of workplace access to men and women.
And is this any way to ruin an airline? Is a play on the is this any way to run an airline, which was Eastern's campaign at the time?
Good point. Yeah, that's surely what was going through the heads of the editorial staff, especially because Eastern was so central to Miami's economy at the time.
Boy, time is flying by, and we've got some other ground to cover. Right, we've only gotten to the '60s, and you've got a little section which I would love you to read. So Diaz basically set the stage for he won his case.
He did win his case,
and that set the stage for men coming into the profession in big numbers. And
right.
You've got a short section you're going to read. Set this up for us, if you would.
Yeah, so Diaz, his court case runs for 3-4 years, and by 1971, the Supreme Court finally signs off on this legal decision that forces every airline in the country to hire men for the first time, some of them. And so what we see in the early 70s is the first re-entry of a significant percentage of men who are going into this workplace. So the numbers are going to go from 4% male to 15% male over the next decade. And it starts with the class of 71, which is the first integrated class. What we notice from the time is that many of these men who are entering this profession are gay. Surprise, surprise, right? And so I'm going to read a paragraph that's centered around one of my favorite quotes that a flight attendant whom I interviewed, who is a member of the class of 71 at Pan Am, he told me about what this job did for his own kind of self-esteem and self-confidence. So it goes like this. "While the overall effect of men entering the career was to significantly desexualize it, many gay men actually embraced the flight attendant's stereotyped role as erotically desirable. Indeed, the long-suppressed 1930s-era notion of the dapper steward, who took part in fashion parades and wore outfits designed to accentuate his slim form, partially returned in the 1970s. As militarized masculinity lost credibility during the 1960s, more space opened for fashionable men who relied on their appearance to feel empowered. Certain stewards relished the chance to make heads turn." And here's the quote. "First, being a Pan Am flight attendant in those days was very prestigious for a gay man because everyone knew it was very hard to get into Pan Am. You weren't ashamed to say what you did. And second, we wore the cutest outfits. We had Adolfo outfits, our luggage matched, we even had umbrellas, and we all looked fabulous. I used to put my uniform on, and I felt really handsome. And I'd walk through terminals, and I knew if there were a gay man, they'd be looking at me. It enhanced you. It gave you self-confidence."
That's Phil Teemeyer reading from his book, Plain Queer, Labor, Sexuality, and AIDS in the History of Male Flight Attendants. I'm Eric Jansen. You're listening to Out on the Bay Gay Radio from San Francisco. Phil, how did the emergence of AIDS affect men in the flight attendant trade?
So AIDS was horrific for the flight attendant corps. I mean, these were men who were living free from family life, who were gallivanting the globe and being paid for it. And many of them, especially that younger generation from the class of 71 onwards, were susceptible to the kind of the silent spread of HIV through the gay community, especially at the time. And one of the hardest things about writing this book was just sitting down and asking former flight attendants and some current flight attendants to reflect on the early AIDS crisis. And so many of them just sort of teared up immediately. And I would ask, you know, the bold question, well, how many people did you, friends, did you lose? And the first one I asked just kind of teared up and he said, you know, I stopped counting when I got to 162. And so it was just devastating. I mean, you had men who were in the prime of their life, and all of a sudden they were falling ill and dying. And then, of course, the media sort of kind of keyed in on one particular flight attendant, Gaetan Dugas, the so-called patient zero of the AIDS crisis, as being the emblematic sort of hedonistic gay man who was very sexually active, who refused to stop having sex when he knew he had HIV/AIDS, and allegedly sort of might have been the very first in North America.
And because he was a flight attendant, he was spreading it in all these cities.
Was there
truth behind this, or was this just kind of a little bit of a fabrication about this particular flight attendant?
The truth element is that Gaetan Dugas existed and cooperated very closely with the CDC in the early years of the epidemic to make sure that the scientists at the CDC had a better sense of how HIV/AIDS was being transmitted and so forth. So he volunteered that he had sexual partners around the continent and so forth. The untruth becomes where San Francisco-based journalist Randy Schiltz promotes the idea that perhaps Gaetan was indeed the very first North American with AIDS, for which he had no epidemiological basis, but was able to kind of construe certain things that CDC folks had written to suggest that perhaps this man was indeed the first.
Thank you so much. Our time is actually coming to a close. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Gay Radio from San Francisco. My guest is Phil Teemeyer, Assistant Professor of History at Philadelphia University and author of Plain Queer, Labor, Sexuality, and AIDS in the History of Male Flight Attendants. You can learn more about the book at Amazon.com or just by Googling Plain Queer, P-L-A-N-E. If you've missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org, where you can also sign up for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher, that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. You can also hear our most recent shows right on the site. And now you can also hear about a dozen of our past favorites from our 8 years on the air. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KLW for studio use and airtime, and tonight's engineer, Joe Burke. Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS or by phone at 415-989-1616. That's sfbar.org/LRIS. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, general comments, and questions. So write to us, eric@outinthebay.com and marilyn@outinthebay.com. By the way, when you're at our website, there are ways you can help us that include donating money, because we are an independent production, not a staff production of KLW. So we've received no funds from KLW. So we need your financial support. It's easy and tax deductible. Hit the donate button at outinthebay.org. And there's other ways you can help us that don't involve your money. You can learn all about it right on the homepage of our website, outinthebay.org. I'm Eric Jansen. Thank you so much for listening. I am out of here.